Consider this. If you could help kids across Canada and Indigenous territories be smarter, healthier, happier, more self-confident and empathetic, better at personal finance, skilled in math and art, and as curious about the material and natural world as they are about what's going on those tiny little screens they so lovingly gaze at, wouldn't you do so? Thanks for tuning in to Digesting Food Studies, the podcast that solves all of the world's problems just by covering that curative and pluralistic field we call food studies. I'm your slightly naive but oh-so-dedicated lunch lady, David Santo. This episode is about school food, and more specifically, how school food programs, well, well-thought-out ones, that is, can offer some pretty amazing returns on investment. As I teased in the opener, re-centralizing food eating, food making, food learning, and food respect in our primary and secondary schools can bring about multiple integrated benefits for our kids. And in the long run, when those kids become adults, they might just be the agents of change that our planet so desperately needs. The article in focus in this episode comes from Volume 5, Issue 3 of Canadian Food Studies, published in September 2018. Our Amuse Bouche segment takes us back 109 years to rural Saskatchewan, as Alexia Moyer tells us how everything old is new again when it comes to the ways that food can be and should be integrated into school curriculums. Plus, there's a recipe for apple compote that you may be very tempted not to try. Following that, I talk with Rachel Engler-Stringer, one of Canada's leading researchers on school food. The CFS article, The Case for a Canadian National School Food Program, co-written with Kimberly Hernandez, Sarah Kirk, Hannah Whitman, and Sasha McNichol, is a fascinating foreshadowing of today as Canada's National School Food Program starts to roll out. And in the aftertaste, food systems researcher and undergraduate student Penelope Stamm unpacks the text in some very thoughtful ways and kind of reinforces the lofty setup I started the episode out with. Well, hi, Alexia. We're going to talk about school food today. Did you pack a school lunch for your kids?
I did, but I found a new trick because if I pack it at night, it saves me 20 minutes in the morning.
Ah, brilliant. And the sandwiches don't get soggy?
No, because they generally have a lot of leftovers and there aren't a lot of sandwiches.
Ah, so your kids are the kids who go into school with good lunches, but then they get looked at by their friends.
Exactly. But I don't care because I have it down to a science.
Of course. But so tell us, how are you going to amuse our bush today with school food subjects?
We're going back in time again today. I have another book for you, 1916 Saskatchewan, published by the Department of Education in Saskatchewan, and it's called The Rural School Luncheon. And I like this book because of the things that remain the same in terms of the argument. So the proposed solution places the responsibility with the school board, the teachers, the parents, and the students themselves.
So a mixed set of responsibilities, a little bit like where we might be going right now with the National School Food Program, but let's wait and see about that.
Now, what stays the same is this establishment of the importance of nutrition to childhood development. So in 1916, they're writing about this. The problem of the school luncheon becomes essentially a problem of education. So they stress the advantages of a good lunch, which gives you increased mental awareness and a greater power of resistance to disease. The concern here is a lack of adequate nutrition, which might lead to, quote, low vitality, end quote, which favors tuberculosis and anemia. A typical lunch in rural Saskatchewan in 1916, what does it look like? Well, it was often packed in a tin pail, so the food would take on the taste of the tin, and the food was wrapped in newspaper, which gave the added flavor of the printer's ink.
Yum.
And some of the lunches were wrapped in cloth, which was not always clean. So the other part of the problem is that the food is actually on offer, leading the Department of Education to conclude that children deserve proper nourishment and served in an attractive way. So let me tell you a little bit about what the proposed solution was and who were the actors who were going to be involved in this. The first is the school board, and they are to provide the equipment. That involves saucepans, frying pans, knives, flour sifter, a can opener, among other things, including 3 asbestos mats. This equipment was to cost between $25 and $35.
So this is a prescription of the provincial government telling the school board what they need to buy for the effectively the cafeteria.
Yes, and it's a long list in terms of the school board's responsibilities, including many of the dry goods, so flour, rolled oats, tins of tomatoes, tins of peas, apricots, but then also cleaning agents like dish soap and then fuel.
So would this have been very new for schools to be getting into the business of school food at this point? Is that why there was such a comprehensive list of items to purchase?
Yes, I did find an American book that was written at the same time, and the lists are very similar. So these ideas are definitely going on across the border as well as here in Canada. The second player is the teacher, who has a big responsibility as well in terms of organization. So he or she is responsible for having this meal preparation work fit within the curriculum and also for coordinating efforts with the children and their parents.
This is a bit like the Japanese system of shokuiku, where the food education was part of the food eating. Like, you learned about food, you made food, then you ate food all within the school context, because of course it was important.
Yes. And the people who are making the food are, as you can imagine, the students themselves. So some will prepare the meal, others will set the table or the desks, and the rest will wash the dishes. And then finally, there are the parents, or I should say the mothers, who are directly addressed. Mm-hmm. Fathers are not mentioned. And they're to provide perishable goods like milk and butter and vegetables. And the school garden supplies many of the vegetables in season.
There was a school garden. So this is all in Saskatchewan, correct?
Yeah.
And very interesting, very specific to place as well, but also perhaps to a sense of collective participation in changing a large system.
Yes. And the learning that was supposed to come with this includes learning how to keep accounts of supplies and costs and recipes. So the students are learning household management, and they provide a list. They will learn neatness, cleanliness, good manners, the proper selection of food, its care, and the importance of thorough mastication and the care of the teeth.
Wow, this is highly prescriptive, but also, why not? It should be part of our education to learn how to eat, not just how to eat, but how to shop, how to manage the accounts, domestic science, nutritional science, social science. I mean, cultural appropriateness of when and how we eat and who we eat with and what the manners are. This is fabulous.
Mm-hmm. It's all there, including the logistics aspect. They're suggesting that every day at the end of the day, the students sit down with the teacher to discuss the recipe for the following day, the quantities that are required, the methods that they're going to use. So this is really a lesson built in to the class.
And maybe a really good model for what's about to come with our National School Food Program, as of course we're living in a place that is much more culturally diverse than it would have been back then. But now, as we get into complexities of school food in very urban centers where there's a huge number of different cultures and food histories going on, that collaboration and participation is so central.
Yeah, and there is room for kind of personal additions to this, because what they're talking about here is a hot meal that is made by the students, but the students can also bring a cold lunch to kind of accompany in terms of snacks, and then they give a number of suggested recipes that would be appropriate and how to prepare them. Now, the book also includes recipes that have been worked out for 18 children, which is a nice size class. I'm sure everyone would wish to have a class of 18 kids. Now, this includes a white sauce, which seems to go with everything from macaroni to potatoes. There's a cream of tomato soup, mashed potatoes. There's an apple compote recipe. But I was struck by the ingredients. For 6 to 9 apples, they recommend adding 2 cups of sugar.
Of course, because the sugar industry had to be represented in all of this propaganda.
So I make the same compote, but with 2 tablespoons. So the proposed program promotes eating and food preparation as a site of learning, as we've said. And the school meal isn't separate from this learning space. So apart from the 2 cups of sugar in the apple compote, there is much that is valuable in this very current 100-year-old book.
Well, let us look to the past as we create the future. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Rachel Engler-Stringer is a professor in community health and epidemiology at the University of Saskatchewan and a leading expert in school food programs, working as an engaged scholar on the many ways in which such programs build value across societies and environments. She's also one of the three editors-in-chief of the Canadian Food Studies Journal, but that's not why she's a guest on this podcast. Well, hello, Rachel. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, and I'm really glad to be talking to you about this article, which is making the case for a national school food program, which you wrote in 2018, way long ago before the school food program was a twinkle in our eyes. Well, I guess it was a twinkle because that's why you were writing about it. But now we've got a whole new reality and a whole new era of school food programs being rolled out. But take me back to 2018 or before 2018 when you were writing this article. What was the landscape like then? And just full disclosure to our audience, you are a co-editor-in-chief of Canadian Food Studies, in addition to being an author and certainly a renowned expert on the subject of school food.
So a little bit of context that I actually think is kind of a fun way to think about how this article came about and where we are at now. So in 2016, I was at the Canadian Association for Food Studies annual meeting, and Food Secure Canada came and they gave a presentation. And what they did is they presented their priorities for food studies researchers, what they'd like us to be working on. And one of those areas was school food. And at the time, I was primarily doing food environments research. And of course, schools are a particular food environment. So it seemed like an obvious area that I could contribute to.
Sure. And also Food Secure Canada's interest in food security, obviously. There is a link there to school food programs as well.
Yeah. So basically, I decided I would respond and I would begin to work on school food. And I end up having conversations with folks at Food Secure Canada. And, you know, Diana Bronson, who at the time was the executive director, I think that was her position. She and I sort of were chatting back and forth, and we decided to pitch me being an academic in residence at Food Secure Canada. And so during that first sabbatical, I went to Montreal and I spent a couple of weeks in person, but I mean, largely it was remote, but there was a couple of weeks where I was in person in the Food Secure Canada offices and we met and we talked about their priorities for research. And I spent a whole bunch of time just delving really deeply into the school food literature. And of course, primarily that was international literature because there's very little research at that time in Canada. And that's really what the genesis of that publication was. And then I needed to step back for various reasons and brought in some other authors and then handed it off to Kimberly Hernandez, who was a PhD student at the time, to kind of finish the article. So that article really kind of culminates in key principles for a potential national school food program for Canada. And then the Coalition for Healthy School Food, who were part of Food Secure Canada, they then took those principles and used them to develop their guiding principles. So the article kind of has an interesting genesis and then where it led to.
It's in some ways sort of parallels the People's Food Policy Project and the evolution of the food policy for Canada and this collaborative, many voices, many hands contributing to what has slowly becoming a better set of policies and hopefully a really great program that can get rolled out across the provinces. Now that we're here in 2025 and the government has announced $1 billion, which of course is not enough to fund all those programs, but enough presumably to start the construction of them and start the provinces figuring out how to make this real. What do you see as the next continuing set of steps in this long and necessary process?
You know, I feel very strongly that what we need to be doing is developing a strong program of research around the implementation of the National School Food Program. So, you know, it's very common that programs get implemented, whether, you know, by different levels of government, and then it really is not any kind of evaluation of them until, you know, they've been in place for a couple of years, if they even undergo evaluation really at all until a certain, you know, time point. I think it's really important that we bring researchers together along with school food communities, school food organizations, to begin the process of studying the National School Food Program in its inception. And so the agreements were signed between the provinces and territories and the federal government over the course of sort of 2024 and early 2025. So they're all in place now. And at this point, there's a few places, especially in Atlantic Canada, where the funding is already kind of rolling out, and a little bit, I think, a beginning in Ontario as well. But in a number of provinces and territories, really that funding has not not start to roll out at all here in Saskatchewan. They have not allocated the funding at all. There's no really yet any public information about exactly how it is going to be allocated. So I wish that the funding were rolling out more quickly. But the nice thing about that from a researcher's standpoint is we can very much follow the implementation.
Okay.
I'm trying really hard to, over the last year, and to bring researchers together with different areas of expertise to really try to get that ball rolling when it comes to research. So I think the thing about school food programs that I absolutely love is that in a way, they're sort of a microcosm of all different areas of food studies. You know, you can look at school food from the perspective of nutrition, from the perspective of labor, from the perspective of feminist food studies, from the perspective of community economic development and local agriculture. All of the things that I teach when I teach around food systems, I could teach in the context of school food.
And there's, I must imagine there are so many challenges and opportunities within this context, both in terms of, you know, making kids' lives better, but then also all the stuff of the upstream procurement of the food, of embedding the school within the food system that is relevant, of thinking about culturally appropriate food, which is, of course, super important. And we're going to be talking to you, Kari Seiko, about school lunch shaming in a future episode, and this whole potential for a school food program to actually cause harm to students by not giving them the food that they are comfortable with or used to or makes them feel well. I know you were doing a quick tour of some European cities recently to look at their school food programs. Is there anything specific there that you discovered that you really think needs to be implemented here, back here in Canada?
Oh, there are so many. So I was in France. I was in three cities in France, two in England, and one in Scotland. Really, there were sort of a series of learnings, I think some of which I'm continuing to sort of wrap my head around. But I think there are some particular areas that we can really learn from. So in France in particular, to a bit of a lesser degree in England, but also in England, what they've been finding is that when they offer vegetarian meals, the uptake is greater. So more kids participate in school food programs. And they're attributing that to there being, you know, a large Muslim population in particular in their schools who aren't going to participate when the main dish is a meat-based main dish. We have sort of conversations about offering halal meat when we're offering meat. And it's a complicated conversation in places like France where offering halal brings with it all sorts of political tensions that bring attention to school food that isn't necessarily desired. And so instead, what they've been doing is offering vegetarian, and they're in a way kind of achieving the same goal in bringing more kids to eat in their school food program. So I think things like that are really interesting. There's a very strong desire, particularly in France, for all kids to eat the same food together. And there's a belief among the academics as well as the practitioners that that act of eating together and everyone eating the same food and there not being separate food for, you know, for some folks versus for others really contributes to that social
sort of cohesion and collectivism. Yeah, well, of course, the whole idea of conviviality and commensality and dare I say communion is about becoming more common with each other, about having shared experiences and then maybe starting to develop shared values. But on the flip side of that is also the risk of trying to force people to assimilate into cultures that they do not belong to necessarily or don't want to belong to just right away. You know, this is a big discussion going on here in Quebec too about whether it's appropriate to try to bring newcomers into the culture or enable the culture to expand to accommodate all these different perspectives and ways of being.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the struggles that perhaps are not achieving quite as well, the kind of the outcomes that they're looking for in France. They are more focused on bringing everyone into, quote, dominant French culture. They're grappling with that perhaps a little bit more than I think in Canada. I think there's a bit more of a recognition that there's a pretty wide range of food cultures in our, you know, in our society. While we may still have a sort of a white European dominant food culture, I would say there's a bit more of an openness to foods from all kinds of places. And so it's a bit of a different tension. And I would argue that we are probably better equipped to deal with that in Canada, but we do still need to be quite careful and thoughtful about how we go about implementing that, that it can't be done in sort of a tokenistic way, that it can't be, oh, on Fridays, we'll offer food from, you know, that kind of thing. But there are some quite good examples within Canada of programs that have done a better job of that. And I think especially when they're in school contexts that are very diverse, where it would be absurd to have a fairly kind of homogeneous set of food offerings. So I think the more cultures and languages represented in a particular school, the better job they do of that. And other school food programs can learn from those sorts of experience. So to me, what France is doing well is that piece around helping kids to see themselves, you know, to get that sort of togetherness around food and the commensality as you described it, but perhaps not quite as well around thinking beyond sort of the dominant French food culture. And then on the other hand, you know, you look at places like, so in Scotland, it was the total opposite. It was much more like Canada. And I said, you know, is it controversial to offer halal meat, for example, in a school food program? And they said, oh, no, not at all. In Scotland, if we just put halal meat into any of the meat dishes, nobody really cares. It's not that big of a deal. And I would say that might be the case, at least in Western Canada. That would just be, well, meat is meat. And it's just...
Well, and it's like halal meat, kosher meat. These are just slaughtering practices. It's not that different. And sometimes it's kind of nicer tasting.
Yes. Yes. Well, yeah. So it's a bit of an interesting one to see what are the challenges in different places. What I saw in the UK, at least one of the locations in England and then in Scotland, I found very interesting is there's this belief that you need to offer choice, like a fair bit of choice, almost like school meals are restaurants where there's sort of three or four different options for main dishes. And then there's a bunch of different sides. And I really struggle with that, I have to say, because I don't think of school food as a restaurant. I think of it more like a family meal where everyone's kind of eating together and somewhat the same foods. Not to say that there can't be any choice. I mean, you know, there's fruits and vegetables to go on the side. You can choose which ones or how much or, you know, those sorts of things. But I do think there's a value in kids eating largely the same food. I had this great conversation with a colleague in one of the cities in England, and we talked about what we called sort of the dreaded cheese sandwich that every school meal seems to offer, include as one of the main dishes, a plain cheese sandwich for those kids who are kind of, you know, pickier eaters or whatever.
The equivalent of buttered noodles.
Yes, exactly. And the problem with that is kids can eat that every day and not necessarily be encouraged, supported by being with peers to try things that they might not otherwise try. So I think choice is a fascinating concept that we need to grapple with as well here in Canada. What does choice mean and how much choice? And does choice mean turning school meals into a restaurant? I'd argue that might not be the best way to go about doing things. Or does choice mean that you can choose from among sort of a basic number of foods offered, how much? And you know, often what you see is sort of two fruits and two vegetables along with a main dish, if which ones you will have of those fruits and vegetables. And
right. So there's a certain degree of agency, but not so much that it makes the student into a consumer at a restaurant. Interesting. Well, it seems like there is a ton of space for research and work and writing and talking and maybe podcasting about the subject. So let's hope that we get it right, or that we can get it good and keep making it right over time. It obviously isn't going to be perfect out of the gate, but imagining this is going to be a lot of people talking about it for a long time, including hopefully a lot of very involved parents, not to put more labor on the shoulders of parents, but it does seem to be a critical element in making school food programs work for that community.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do see both the way the National School Food Program will hopefully roll out. You know, we'll see certain interventions that there will be some reflection on those interventions, and those interventions will continue to grow and become stronger over time. Just as those of us who are researchers, you know, we start with a certain amount of research, and then that research kind of grows and evolves over time in response to what's happening in communities, in partnership with parents and schools and so on. So I see this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my career. So I'm hoping it continues to be as fascinating and as I like feeling useful. So this to me feels like an area of research where I can both, you know, grow intellectually, but also be really useful.
Well, I think the article that you've published already laid a groundwork of usefulness. The work you're doing now clearly is going to develop into some really important, useful outcomes and outputs. So thank you. Well, not that I've got kids, but you know, I'm sure parents all across Canada will be thanking you at some point in their future. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Next up, undergraduate student Penelope Stamm reflects on our focus article, The Case for a Canadian National School Food Program, adding perspectives from her own experience doing research on food systems. As she points out, it's astounding that at the time the article was written, Canada didn't have a national school food program. And while the policy, planning, and financing that the federal government announced in 2024 is a fantastic step forward, there is still a vast swath of realities that need to be enacted for us to claim that we truly have a national program. As the saying goes, there's many a slip twixt cup and lip.
I'm Penelope Stamm, a fourth-year undergraduate student at Western University, where I study anthropology and geography. I also work as a research assistant with Food Research Action Montreal at Dawson College, under the supervision of Annalisa Aunio, where I explore how cities, especially Montreal, can build sustainable food systems that are just, inclusive, and accessible to all. When I read The Case for a Canadian National School Food Program by Hernandez and her colleagues, it felt like someone had bottled every conversation I've had about food justice over the past year and then added data, policy, and history to back it up. As someone who grew up attending public schools in Quebec and eating cafeteria lunches, I felt like this topic really resonated with me. The most obvious takeaway from this article is that Canada doesn't have a national school food program. Let that sink in. We're one of the only countries in the OECD that doesn't offer universal, consistent school meals. Meanwhile, other countries like Japan, Italy, and Brazil have woven food into their education systems. There, school food programs go beyond feeding students and are actually integrated into the curriculum. In Japan, for example, kids serve each other lunch and learn about food waste and manners. While in Italy, the midday meal is tied to lessons on farming, culture, and even climate change. This is something that I would have found super useful during my time in public school, especially learning about how food gets from farm to table. Here in Canada, we're still stuck in this patchwork approach, which relies on parent volunteers, charity models, and fundraisers that don't survive staff turnover and aren't a real long-term sustainable solution. As someone researching sustainable food systems, I found the Canadian case studies in the article really exciting. Programs in BC, Nova Scotia, and Ontario are already showing how school meals can be transformative, not just for nutrition, but for confidence, social connection, and even academic success. For instance, BC's Project Chef taught children how to chop, measure, and cook, which are valuable life skills that not everyone may have the privilege to learn at home. The result? The kids didn't just become better eaters. They became more independent and more curious about where their food comes from. And we can't ignore the equity piece. Food insecurity is still a reality for many families in Canada, which is something I've encountered many times during my research work. And while we often talk about the cost of implementing a national food program, we don't always talk about the cost of not having one. The burnout, shame, stress, and poor health outcomes that are associated with this issue. Universal school meals could reduce the invisible food labor that falls disproportionately on women and single parents. I believe it's important to look at these programs as a way to make food and food education more accessible to all, since at its root, it is also a gender equity issue. Another thing that this article really helped me see is that school food is infrastructure. Just like public transit or healthcare, it's something that should be accessible to all and designed for and with the community of today and tomorrow in mind, not just corporate interests. And when school food is education integrated, which is when kids are growing vegetables in gardens, learning about local farms, and cooking in class, it doesn't just change how they eat. It changes how they see food, value food, and even talk about food, which has lasting positive impacts on their health and attitudes towards food. To other students, researchers, or listeners who care about social justice, health, or education, I'd say this. Use this article as a springboard. Whether you're designing a policy proposal, starting a school garden, or writing a paper, there's so much here to build from. This article has so many good examples of successful food programs that could be adapted to local needs of Canadian communities. Because sometimes, the most powerful forms of activism start small and local, and every small step towards a national school food program is important. And maybe that's what school food policy can be, not just lunch, but a central part of learning.
When I think back to my school food days, I think of overworked lunch ladies ladling out not-so-inspired stewy stuff into mostly clean melamine bowls. I think of the slightly molding knishes and malted milk ice cream bars that I could afford with my minimal pocket change. I also think of the slices of green pepper that my mother used to wrap in wax paper for my lunchbox, and that so sad day in second grade when I dropped a blob of tartar sauce on my brand new brown hush puppies, my suede shoes that my parents had just splurged on and that I was so proud of. Anyway, it's a mixed bag of memories, and not so gastronomic. But maybe there's a shinier and more nurturing food reality for school kids in the very near future. We shall see. Thank you so much to my guests for throwing themselves into the good food fight, Alexia Moyer, Rachel Engler-Stringer, and Penelope Stamm. Our music comes from Alex Guz and Evgeny Bardugia on Pixabay, and our executive producers are Rachel Engler-Stringer, Laurence Godin, Charles Levko, Phil Loring, and Kristen Lowett. I'm David Santo. Our show notes cover a few additional details, and there's a link to the federal government's webpage on the National School Food Program. Please check it out and keep our provinces and school boards honest as the programs come online and keep being improved. Without putting any shame, blame, or guilt on top of our already overworked and underpaid school teachers and administrators, wouldn't it be great if food were as fundamental to learning as paper and pen, or chalk and slate, or video and screen? What if our politicians took all that energy they spend freaking out about bathroom usage, spirituality spaces, book content, and civil language, and instead put it towards healing the fundamentally broken relationship between eaters and eaten? What if we actually learned to be humans in school by starting with our stomachs, and then extending outward to the rest of our gangly, greasy, and growing bodies? What might that do?